know if it's a good thing or not that Jesus is watching us so closely. Maybe it depends on where we situate ourselves in this gospel story today. There are two sets of characters on the surface. There are the religious leaders who are insecure in their need to have public honor and respect. On the other hand, there is this poor widow who has nothing, destitute, all but invisible to the public. And the contrast is stark, and it is meant to be. And I want to suggest that there's a lot more going on in this story than a traditional kind of good guys, bad guy, or good woman, bad guys sort of motif. The gospel today tells us something about what we make of our religion, okay? So in the context of Mark's gospel now, we are in the last week of Jesus' life. What we know happened in those last days after his triumphal entry and before his crucifixion is that every day he would get up in the morning very early from over on the Mount of Olives, east of Jerusalem, walk down the mountain, through the valley, and up into the temple to teach, to be a presence there. And he was attracting a lot of interest because the crowds were getting up early with him to come and hear what he had to say. He was also drawing a lot of attention from the religious leaders, Sadducees, Pharisees, and scribes, all mentioned in Mark's gospel as those who were sort of increasingly anxious about this religious leader and what he might mean for themselves. So we hear in the midst of all of that this famed story of the so-called widow's mite. And I want to suggest to you also that there is another character that I haven't mentioned yet that is very significant in this story. It sits there on the stage, enormous, although silent, without lines, still incredibly significant, and that is the backdrop here of the temple itself. For hundreds of years, including up through the first century, the time of Jesus, for the Jews, there are three primary physical symbols of their faith, their relationship. Three. First of all, there's the Torah, the law, their scriptures. Secondly, there's the land itself. And thirdly, there is the temple. And space prevents a long theological explanation of temple theology here. But the temple was, for the Jews, sort of the navel of the universe, the place where heaven and earth met, the place where God and God's people came to meet. And they had to meet frequently because God's people were frequently alienated from God. And the temple was the place where the covenant, the relationship, was renewed, made right again. And it was made right again through sacrifices. A sacrifice, really simple definition, is that something of value is given and something of even greater value is received. So the sacrificial system was such that humanity, the Jews, recognizing that they had alienated themselves from God, would offer back to God something of value to themselves, animals, other types of sacrifices, and in return, something of greater value was given, and that is a restored relationship. I'm not trying to be flippant with this analogy, but you might think of the temple and the kind of the sacrificial system there as a very intentional date night between a husband and a wife. Once a week, you know, we're going to come together, and the purpose of our coming together is not simply to have wine and a nice meal and enjoy one another romantically, but we're going to look at each other and see if there's something in our relationship that needs to be addressed, worked out, and we'll remember in that why we got married in the first place. Okay, that's kind of what happens at the temple. And the letter to the Hebrews that you heard a minute ago kind of gets at that, except here's the problem. You have to have a date night, at least I seem to, you know, a lot. And because we can get everything right, and the next morning, things start, you know, going awry again, and that's just the way it is in our relationships, right? And what happens in the temple is that there's a whole never-ending cycle of sacrifices, and there are people in charge of all of that sacrificial system who, in effect, have authority over your religious life. Okay? Sadducees, Pharisees, scribes, those priests there. Another way to think about this is like your lawn, especially this time of year. Is it worth cutting the grass one more time? leaves are falling. Either you will make a sacrifice of your time and energy to deal with your lawn, or you'll make a sacrifice to pay somebody else to come do it. But what happens? It looks good for a day or two, and then you're going to have to call back the landscaping service. So you're going to have to get back out there again to fix up your lawn. A never-ending system of sort of lawn improvement services. And this requires self-sacrifice, but self-sacrifice is a very poor substitute to getting to God through Jesus Christ, because the gospel is about our lives in light of God's sacrifice. And that's what we need to get to and what Jesus is leading us into. So Jesus is there in the temple, and it's organized with three courts as you get closer and closer to the sanctuary, the Holy of Holies. There's the court of the nations, the court of women, and then the court of Israel inside that. Jesus is in that middle court where all Jews are welcomed, and there are 13 trumpet-shaped receptacles to receive offerings that support that landscape improvement scheme known as the temple. Again, think of the temple as the supreme metaphor for a system of self-sacrifice in order to get right with God. And Jesus is looking at those who give in large sums of money, and he frankly looks on them with some criticism, to put it mildly. Then this widow puts in something that's so small, you'd have to read it in the Greek to get this. Scholars help me with that. Mark has to actually explain what the two little copper coins, it's not even in circulation in Rome. It's not Roman currency. It's so insignificant. And I've read that it represents about 0.7% of a daily wage. So all this poor widow has is about 3 minutes and 20 seconds worth of a day's work. And she has two coins that equal that. She could have put in one and kept the other for herself, but no, she puts in everything that she has. This is great stewardship material here for us, right? It's the stewardship season. This is like the baseball set on the tee. We have so much compared to the widow, and she gives everything. If we only gave even 5% of our income, our budget here would go up 10 times. That's the sermon I'm not going to give. So you can thank me for that later. But that's not even really the best question. The best question from the story is not how much is enough for me to sacrifice in order to get my religion right, but what was enough for God to sacrifice to get right with me? And then what is my response to God's sacrifice? And the poor widow shows us what that looks like. She has nothing to give. That's the point. She has nothing to give, and she just simply gives her life, and that is what is blessed. Out of her poverty, she put in everything she had. We need this woman pointed out to us. There's nothing in the gospel story that tells us that anyone else noticed her. Jesus noticed her. Jesus points her out for us. Hey, y'all, I know your eyes want to go to the rich people over here, but look at this woman right here. And we look at her as a sympathetic character, but I think actually Jesus means that she's a threat to us. Earlier, just before this story, Jesus is asked by one of his antagonists a setup question, what law is the greatest? And Jesus responds, you know the answer to that. Love your God with all your heart, with all your mind, with all your strength, with all your soul. And who can do that? This woman does that. We love our yards neat and tidy. They just don't stay that way. We love to be like those religious leaders, in our long, pretty robes to get the respect of those around us. But we have to keep working it, don't we? Just like they had to keep sacrificing over and over and over again. Because of some family history, I am pretty familiar with the 12 steps. And I'm also familiar through my pastoral ministry with you all. Priest Richard Rohr has written really some good stuff about the 12 steps and the spirituality of the 12 steps. And he says that the genius of this 12-step movement, things like Alcoholics Anonymous, is the call to complete surrender of any notion that we have some kind of personal resources that will overcome our problems or our addictions, that we are powerless over it, and we need to surrender into that reality. And that's the genius. He says, the old ego will always prefer an economy of merit and sacrifice to any economy of grace and unearned love where we have no control. So my younger brother Bill was an alcoholic. And I'm not throwing him under the bus by telling you a bit of his story today, because he in heaven would want you to hear this testimony. But we went through about a 7 or 8 year period where it was an absolute hell for him. And it was hell for his family and those who loved him. And he went through a number of treatment centers, rehab, halfway houses. And I remember the first time he worked for a very great law firm in downtown Richmond. And they sent him off to a rehab place in Pennsylvania for 30 days. And I talked to him the day he got out, and he said to me, it was great. I think everybody should do something like that. I learned a lot about myself. I'm fine. And that was his tone. And I thought, I hung up the phone, I looked at Susie, I said, that didn't sound good. He was back in rehab in about 60 days. Over those 7 or 8 years, he went through two long stretches of sobriety recovery. One was 12 months and one was 18 months. And if you talk to him in either of those two stretches, this is what he sounded like. He says, I wake up every day and I have no control. I'm utterly powerless. If I don't go to AA, if I don't do these things, if I don't remember how this thing has such a grip on me every minute of every hour of every day, I am helpless. And when he stood in that place, he was sober. 1 week before he died, he told my father, I think I got this thing licked. Self-sufficiency. Again, I'm not throwing him under the bus. If there's one thing in heaven he would want us to hear is how wrong he was and how wrong we can be too if we think we live in our self-sufficiency and our own self-sacrifice will get us the life to which we're called. So the Christian tradition quite rightly honors this nameless widow, her devotion. But the fact of the matter is, we're never going to be able to meet our budget with a bunch of poor widows, are we? So we have to remember what this story is actually all about ourselves. I do. The point is not that this woman heroically sacrificed everything she had. Again, the point is that she had nothing. There was no pretense of self-sufficiency before God at all. Blessed are the poor in spirit, Jesus says. And again, I want to stress this. The insignificance, the invisibility of this poor widow is meant to stand in stark contrast to the immensity and the complexity, the enormity of the temple complex. What ways are we caught up in a temple complex in this environment here? And it is very significant that Jesus himself never went into the Holy of Holies. He never performed a single priestly function. He never did one thing as that kind of religious leader to try to earn grace and love. Not once. But he did everything to earn ours. She, out of her poverty, has put in everything she had. And he, out of his poverty, has put in everything he had for us and for our sake.